Full Dark, No Stars, Disc 8.
37. Unlike Lacemaker Lane, there was nothing suburban about Township Road. It was as country as Travis Tritt. The houses were glimmering islands of electric light beneath the glow of the rising moon. Tess, you are approaching your destination, Tom said in his non-imaginary voice. She breasted a rise, and there on her left was a mailbox marked Strelke and 23. The driveway was long, rising on a curve, paved with asphalt, smooth as black ice. Tess turned in without hesitation, but apprehension dropped over her as soon as Township Road was behind her. She had to fight to keep from jamming on the brakes and backing out again, because if she kept going, she had no choice. She'd be like a bug in a bottle. And even if he wasn't married, what if someone else was up there at the house? Brother Les, for instance. What if Big Driver had been at Tommy's buying beer and snacks, not for one, but for two? Tess killed her headlights and drove on by moonlight. In her keyed-up state, the driveway seemed to go on forever, but it could have been no more than an eighth of a mile before she saw the lights of Strelke's house. It was at the top of the hill, a tidy-looking place that was bigger than a cottage but smaller than a farmhouse. Not a house of bricks, but not a humble house of straw either. In the story of the three little pigs and the big bad wolf, Tess reckoned this would have been the house of sticks. Parked on the left side of the house was a long trailer box with Red Hawk Trucking on the side. Parked at the end of the driveway, in front of the garage, was the cab over Pete from the website. It looked haunted in the moonlight. Tess slowed as she approached it, and then she was flooded with a white glare that dazzled her eyes and lit the lawn and the driveway. It was a motion-activated pole light, and if Strelke came back while it was on, he would be able to see its glow at the foot of his driveway, maybe even while he was still approaching on Township Road. She jammed on the brakes, feeling as she had when, as a teenager, she dreamed of finding herself in school with no clothes on. She heard a woman groaning. She supposed it was her, but it didn't sound or feel like her.
This isn't good, Tess.
Shut up, Tom.
He could come back any minute, and you don't know how long the timer on that thing is. You had trouble with the mother. He's much bigger than her.
I said shut up. She tried to think, but that blaring light made it hard. Shadows from the parked cab over in the long box to her left seemed to reach for her with sharp black fingers. Boogeyman fingers. Goddamn pole light. Of course a man like him would have a pole light. She ought to go right now. Just turn around on his lawn and drive back down to the road as fast as she could. But she would meet him if she did. She knew it. And with the element of surprise gone, she would die. Think, Tessa Jean, think.
And oh God, just to make things a little worse, a dog started barking. There was a dog in the house. She imagined a pit bull with a head full of jutting teeth. If you're going to stay, you need to get out of sight, Tom said. And no, that didn't sound like her voice, or not exactly like her voice. Perhaps it was the one that belonged to her deepest self. The survivor. And the killer. Her too. How many unsuspected selves could a person have hiding deep inside? She was beginning to think the number might be infinite. She glanced into her rearview mirror, chewing at her still swollen lower lip. No approaching headlights yet, but would she even be able to tell given the combined brilliance of the moon and that Christing pole light? It's on a timer, Tom said. But I'd do something before it goes out, Tess. If you move the car after it does, you'll only trip it again. She threw the Expedition into four-wheel, started to swing around the cab over, then stopped. There was high grass on that side. In the pitiless glare of the pole light, he couldn't help but see the track she would leave. Even if the Christing light went out, it would come back on again when he drove up, and then he would see them. Inside, the dog continued to weigh in.
Yuck, yuck, yuck.
Drive across the lawn and put it behind the long box, Tom said.
The tracks, though. The tracks.
You have to hide it somewhere, Tom returned. He spoke apologetically but firm. At least the grass is mown on that side. Most people are pretty unobservant, you know. Doreen Marquis says that all the time.
Strelke's not a knitting society lady. He's a fucking lunatic.
But because there was really no choice, not now that she was up here, Tess drove onto the lawn and toward the parked silver long box through a glare that seemed as bright as a summer noonday. She did it with her bottom slightly raised off the seat, as if by doing that, she could somehow magically render the tracks of the expedition's passage less visible.
Even if the motion light is still on when he comes back, he may not be suspicious, Tom said. I'll bet deer trip it all the time. He might even have a light like that to scare them out of his vegetable garden.
This made sense, and it sounded like her special Tom voice again, but it did not comfort her much.
Yark, 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 yark.
Whatever it was, it sounded like it was shitting nickels in there. The ground behind the silver box was bumpy and bald. Other freight boxes had no doubt been parked on it from time to time, but solid enough. She drove the expedition as deep into the long box's shadow as she could, then killed the engine. She was sweating heavily, producing a rank aroma no deodorant would be able to defeat. She got out, and the motion light went out when she slammed the door. For one superstitious moment, Tess thought she had done it herself, then realized the scary fucking thing had just timed out. She leaned over the warm hood of the expedition, pulling in deep breaths and letting them out like a runner in the last quarter mile of a marathon. It might come in handy to know how long it had been on, but that was a question she couldn't answer. She had been too scared. It had seemed like hours. When she had herself under control again, she took inventory, forcing herself to move slowly and methodically. Pistol and oven glove, both present and accounted for. She didn't think the oven glove would muffle another shot, not with the hole in it. She'd have to count on the isolation of the little hilltop house. It was okay that she'd left the knife in Ramona's belly. If she were reduced to trying to take out Big Driver with a butcher knife, she'd be in serious trouble. And there are only 4 shots left in the gun. You better not forget that and just start spraying him. Why didn't you bring any more bullets, Tessa Jean? You thought you were planning, but I don't think you did a very good job.
Shut up, she whispered. Tom or Fritzy or whoever you are, just shut up.
The scolding voice ceased, and when it did, Tess realized the world had also gone silent. The dog had ceased its mad barking when the pole light went off. Now, the only sound was the wind, and the only light was the moon. 38. With that terrible glare gone, the long box provided excellent cover, but she couldn't stay there, not if she meant to do what she had come here to do. Tess scurried around the back of the house, terrified of tripping another motion light, but feeling she had no choice. There was no light to trip, but the moon went behind a cloud and she stumbled over the cellar bulkhead, almost hitting her head on a wheelbarrow when she went to her knees. For a moment, as she lay there, she wondered again what she had turned into. She was a member of the Authors Guild who had shot a woman in the head not long ago, after stabbing her in the stomach.
I've gone entirely off the reservation.
Then she thought of him calling her a bitch, a whiny whore bitch, and quit caring about whether she was on or off the reservation. It was a stupid saying anyway, and racist in the bargain. Strelke did have a garden behind his house, but it was small and apparently not worth protecting from the depredations of the deer with a motion light. There was nothing left in it anyway except for a few pumpkins, most now rotting on the vine. She stepped over the rows, rounded the far corner of the house, and there was the cab over. The moon had come out again and turned its chrome to the liquid silver of sword blades in fantasy novels. Tess came up behind it, walked along the left side, and knelt by the chin-high,
to her at least, front wheel. She took the lemon squeezer out of her pocket. He couldn't drive into his garage because the cab over was in the way. Even if it hadn't been, the garage was probably full of bachelor rickrack, tools, fishing gear, camping gear, truck parts, cases of discount soda. That's just guessing. It's dangerous to guess. Doreen would scold you for it. Of course she would. No one knew the Knitting Society ladies better than Tess did. But those dessert-loving babies rarely took chances. When you did take them, you were forced to make a certain number of guesses. Tess looked at her watch and was astounded to see it was only 25 to 10. It seemed that she had fed Fritzy double rations and left the house 4 years ago, maybe five. She thought she heard an approaching engine, then decided she didn't. She wished the wind wasn't blowing so hard, but wish in one hand and shit in the other and see which one fills up first. It was a saying no Knitting Society lady had ever voiced. Doreen Markey and her friends were more into things like, soonest begun, soonest done. But it was a true saying just the same. Maybe he really was going on a trip, Sunday night or not. Maybe she was still going to be here when the sun came up, chilled to her already aching bones by the constant wind combing this lonely hilltop where she was crazy to be. No, he's the crazy one. Remember how he danced, his shadow dancing on the wall behind him? Remember how he sang, his squalling voice? You wait for him, Tessa Jean. You wait until hell freezes over. You've come too far to turn back. She was afraid of that, actually. It can't be a decorous drawing room murder. You understand that, don't you? She did. This particular killing, if she was able to bring it off, would be more Death Wish than Willow Grove Knitting Society goes backstage. He would pull in, hopefully right up to the cab over she was hiding behind. He would douse the lights of the pickup, and before his eyes could adjust. It wasn't the wind this time. She recognized the badly tuned thump of the engine even before the headlights splashed up the curve of the drive. Tess got on one knee and yanked the brim of her cap down so the wind wouldn't blow it off. She would have to approach, and that meant her timing would have to be exquisite. If she tried to shoot him from ambush, she would quite likely miss even at close range. The gun instructor had told her she could only count on the lemon squeezer at 10 feet or less. He had recommended she buy a more reliable handgun, but she never had. And getting close enough to make sure of killing him wasn't all. She had to make sure it was Strelke in the truck, and not the brother or some friend. I have no plan. But it was too late to plan, because it was the truck, and when the pole light came on, she saw the brown cap with the bleach splatters on it. She also saw him wince against the glare, as she had, and knew he was momentarily blinded. It was now, or not at all.
I am the courageous woman.
With no plan, without even thinking, she walked around the back of the cab over, not running, but taking big, calm strides. The wind gusted around her, flapping her cargo pants. She opened the passenger door and saw the ring with the red stone on his hand. He was grabbing a paper bag with the shape of a square box inside it. Beer, probably a 12-pack. He turned toward her, and something terrible happened. She divided in two. The courageous woman saw the animal that had raped her, choked her, and put her in a pipe with two other rotting bodies. Tess saw the slightly broader face and lines around the mouth and eyes that hadn't been there on Friday afternoon. But even as she was registering these things, the lemon squeezer barked twice in her hand. The first bullet punctured Strelke's throat, just below the chin. The second opened a black hole above his bushy right eyebrow and shattered the driver's side window. He fell backward against the door, the hand that had been grasping the top of the paper bag dropping away. He gave a monstrous whole body twitch, and the hand with the ring on it thudded against the middle of the steering wheel, honking the horn. Inside the house, the dog began to bark again.
No, it's him.
She stood at the open door with the gun in her hand, staring in.
It's gotta be him.
She rushed around the front of the pickup, lost her balance,
went to one knee, got up, and yanked open the driver's side door. Strelke fell out and hit his dead head on the smooth asphalt of his driveway. His hat fell off. His right eye, pulled out of true by the bullet that had entered his head just above it, stared up at the moon. The left one stared at Tess. And it wasn't the face that finally convinced her. The face with lines on it she was seeing for the very first time. The face pitted with old acne scars that hadn't been there on Friday afternoon. Was he big or real big? Betsy Neal had asked. Real big, Tess had replied. And he had been, but not as big as this man. Her rapist had been 6'6", she had thought when he got out of the truck. This truck. She was in no doubt about that. Deep in the belly, thick in the thighs, and as wide as a doorway. But this man had to be at least 6'9". She had come hunting a giant and killed a leviathan.
Oh my God,
Tess said, and the wind whipped her words away.
Oh my dear God, what have I done?
You killed me, Tess, the man on the ground said. And that certainly made sense, given the hole in his head and the one in his throat.
You went and killed Big Driver, just like you meant to.
The strength left her muscles. She went to her knees beside him. Overhead, the moon beamed down from the roaring sky.
The ring, she whispered. The hat. The truck.
He wears the ring and the hat when he goes hunting, Big Driver said. And he drives the pickup. When he goes hunting, I'm on the road in a Red Hawk cab over. And if anyone sees him, especially if he's sitting down, they think they're seeing me.
Why would he do that?
Tess asked the dead man. You're his brother.
Because he's crazy,
Big Driver said patiently. And because it worked before, Doreen Marquis said, when they were younger and Lester got in trouble with the police. The question is whether Roscoe Strelke committed suicide because of that first trouble or because Ramona made Big Brother Al take the blame for it. Or maybe Roscoe was going to tell and Ramona killed him, made it look like suicide. Which way was it, Al? But on this subject, Al was quiet. Dead quiet, in fact. I'll tell you how I think it was, Doreen said in the moonlight. I think Ramona knew that if your little brother wound up in an interrogation room with an even half-smart policeman, he might confess to something a lot worse than touching a girl on the school bus or peeking into cars on the local lover's lane or whatever 10-cent crime it was he'd been accused of. I think she talked you into taking the blame, and she talked her husband into dummying up. Or browbeat him into it. That's more like it. And either because the police never asked the girl to make a positive identification or because she wouldn't press charges, they got away with it. Al said nothing. Tess thought, I'm kneeling here talking in imaginary voices. I've lost my mind. Yet part of her knew she was trying to keep her mind. The only way to do it was to understand, and she thought the story she was telling in Doreen's voice was either true or close to true. It was based on guesswork and slopped on deduction, but it made sense. It fit in with what Ramona had said in her last moments.
You stupid cunt. You don't know what you're talking about.
And?
You don't understand. It's a mistake.
It was a mistake, all right. Everything she'd done tonight had been a mistake.
No, not everything. She was in on it. She knew.
Did you know? Tess asked the man she had killed. She reached out to grab Strelke's arm, then drew away. It would be still warm under his sleeve. Still thinking it was alive.
Did you?
He didn't answer.
Let me try,
Doreen said, and in her kindliest, you can tell me everything old lady voice, the one that always worked in the book, she asked,
how much did you know, Mr. Driver?
I sometimes suspected,
he said.
Mostly I didn't think about it. I had a business to run.
Did you ever ask your mother?
I might have, he said.
and Tess thought his strangely cocked right eye evasive. But in that wild moonlight, who could tell about such things? Who could tell for sure?
When the girls disappeared, is that when you asked?
To this, Big Driver made no reply, perhaps because Doreen had begun to sound like Fritzy, and like Tom the Tom-Tom, of course.
But there was never any proof, was there?
This time it was Tess herself. She wasn't sure he would answer her voice, but he did.
No, no proof. And you didn't want proof, did you?
No answer this time. So Tess got up and walked unsteadily to the bleach-splattered brown hat, which had blown across the driveway and onto the lawn. Just as she picked it up, the pole light went off again. Inside, the dog stopped barking. This made her think of Sherlock Holmes. And standing there in the windy moonlight, Tess heard herself voicing the saddest chuckle to ever come from a human throat. She took off her hat, stuffed it into her jacket pocket, and put his on in its place. It was too big for her, so she took it off again, long enough to adjust the strap in back. She returned to the man she had killed, the one she judged perhaps not quite innocent, but surely too innocent to deserve the punishment the courageous woman had meted out. She tapped the brim of the brown hat and asked,
"Is this the one you wear when you go on the road?"
Knowing it wasn't. Strelke didn't answer, but Doreen Marquis, doyenne of the Knitting Society, did.
"Of course not. When you're driving for Red Hawk, you wear a Red Hawk cap, don't you, dear?"
"Yes," Strelke said.
"And you don't wear your ring either, do you?"
"Nah, too gaudy for customers. Not businesslike. And what if someone at one of those skanky truck stops, someone too drunk or stoned to know better, saw it and thought it was real? No one would risk mugging me. I'm too big and strong for that. At least I was until tonight. But someone might shoot me, and I don't deserve to be shot. Not for a fake ring, and not for the terrible things my brother might have done."
"And you and your brother never drive for the company at the same time, do you, dear?"
"No. When he's out on the road, I mind the office. When I'm out on the road, he... well, I guess you know what he does when I'm out on the road."
"You should have told!" Tess screamed down at him. "Even if you only suspected, you should have told!"
"He was scared," Doreen said in her kindly voice. "Weren't you, dear?"
"Yes," Al said. "I was scared."
"Of your brother?"
Tess asked, either unbelieving or not wanting to believe.
"Scared of your kid brother?"
"Not him," Al Strelke said. "Her."
39. When Tess got back in her car and started the motor, Tom said,
"There was no way you could know, Tess. And it all happened so fast."
That was true, but it ignored the central looming fact. By going after her rapist like a vigilante in a movie, she had sent herself to hell. She raised the gun to her temple, then lowered it again. She couldn't. Not now. She still had an obligation to the women in the pipe, and any other women who might join them if Lester Strelke escaped. And after what she had just done, it was more important than ever that he not escape. She had one more stop to make, but not in her expedition.
40. The driveway at 101 Township Road wasn't long, and it wasn't paved. It was just a pair of ruts with bushes growing close enough to scrape the sides of the blue F-150 pickup truck as she drove it up to the little house. Nothing neat about this one. This one was a huddled old creep manse that could have been straight out of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. How life did imitate art sometimes. And the cruder the art, the closer the imitation. Tess made no attempt at stealth. Why bother to kill the headlights when Lester Strelke would know the sound of his brother's truck almost as well as the sound of his brother's voice? She was still wearing the bleach-splattered brown cap Big Driver wore when he wasn't on the road. The lucky cap,
that turned out to be unlucky in the end. The ring with the fake ruby stone was far too big for any of her fingers, so she had put it in the left front pocket of her cargo pants. Little Driver had dressed and driven as his big brother when he went out hunting, and while he might never have time enough, or brains enough, to appreciate the irony of his last victim coming to him with the same accessories, Tess did. She parked by the back door, turned off the engine, and got out. She carried the gun in one hand. The door was unlocked. She stepped into a shed that smelled of beer and spoiled food. A single 60-watt bulb hung from the ceiling on a length of dirty cord. Straight ahead were four overflowing plastic garbage cans, the 32-gallon kinds you could buy at Walmart. Behind them, stacked against the shed wall, were what looked like 5 years' worth of Uncle Henry's swap guide. To the left was another door, up a single step. It would lead to the kitchen. It had an old-fashioned latch rather than a knob. The door squalled on unoiled hinges when she depressed the latch and pushed it open. An hour ago, such a squall would have terrified her into immobility. Now it didn't bother her in the slightest. She had work to do. That was all it came down to, and it was a relief to be free of all that emotional baggage. She stepped into the smell of whatever greasy meat Little Driver had fried for his supper. She could hear a TV laugh track. Some sitcom. Seinfeld, she thought.
What the hell are you doing here?
Lester Strelke called from the vicinity of the laugh track.
I ain't got but a beer and a half left if that's what you came for. I'm gonna drink up and then go to bed.
She followed the sound of his voice.
If you'd have called, I could have saved you the trouble.
She came into the room. He saw her. Tess hadn't speculated on what his reaction might be to the reappearance of his last victim, carrying a gun and wearing the hat Lester himself wore when his urges came over him. Even if she had, she could never have predicted the extremity of the one she saw. His mouth dropped open, and then his entire face froze. The can of beer he was holding dropped from his hand and fell into his lap, spraying foam onto his only article of clothing, a pair of yellowing jockey shorts.
He's seeing a ghost,
she thought as she walked toward him, raising the gun.
Good.
There was time to see that, although the living room was a bachelor mess, and there were no snow globes or cutie poo figurines. The TV watching setup was the same as the one at his mother's house on Lacemaker Lane. The lazy boy, the TV tray, here holding a final unopened can of Pabst Blue Ribbon and a bag of Doritos instead of Diet Coke and cheese doodles. The same TV guide, the one with Simon Cowell on it.
You're dead,
he whispered.
No,
Tess replied. She put the barrel of the lemon squeezer against the side of his head. He made one feeble effort to grab her wrist, but it was far too little and much too late.
That's you.
She pulled the trigger. Blood came out of his ear and his head snapped briskly to the side. He looked like a man trying to free up a kink in his neck. On the TV, George Costanza said,
I was in the pool! I was in the pool!
The audience laughed. 41. It was almost midnight, and the wind was blowing harder than ever. When it gusted, Lester Strelke's whole house shook, and each time Tess thought of the little pig who had built his house out of sticks. The little piggy who had lived in this one would never have to worry about his shitty house blowing away, because he was dead in his lazy boy.
And he wasn't a little piggy anyway,
Tess thought.
He was a big, bad wolf.
She was sitting in the kitchen, writing on the pages of a grimy blue horse tablet she had found in Strelke's upstairs bedroom. There were four rooms on the second floor, but the bedroom was the only one not stuffed with junk. Everything from iron bedsteads to an Evinrude boat motor that looked as if it might have been dropped from the top of a five-story building. Because it would take weeks or months to go through those caches of the useless, the worthless, and the pointless, Tess turned all her attention on Strelke's bedroom and searched it carefully. The blue horse tablet was a bonus. She had found what she was looking for,
in an old travel tote pushed to the very back of the closet shelf, where it had been camouflaged, not very successfully, with old issues of National Geographic. In it was a tangle of women's underwear. Her own panties were on top. Tess put them in her pocket and, pack rat-like, replaced them with a coil of yellow boat line. Nobody would be surprised to find rope in a rapist killer's suitcase of trophy lingerie. Besides, she would not be needing it.
"Tonto," said the Lone Ranger, "our work here is done."
What she wrote, as Seinfeld gave way to Frasier and Frasier gave way to the local news, one Chicopee resident had won the lottery and another had suffered a broken back after falling from a scaffolding, so that balanced out, was a confession in the form of a letter. As she reached page 5, the TV news gave way to an apparently endless commercial for Almighty Cleanse. Danny Vieira was saying, "Some Americans have a bowel movement only once every 2 or 3 days, and because this has gone on for years, they believe it's normal. Any doctor worth his salt will tell you it's not." The letter was headed "To the Proper Authorities," and the first 4 pages consisted of a single paragraph. In her head, it sounded like a scream. Her hand was tired, and the ballpoint pen she'd found in the kitchen drawer, Red Hawk Trucking printed in faded gilt on the barrel, was showing signs of drying up. But she was, thank God, almost done. While Little Driver went on not watching TV from where he sat in his Lazy Boy, she at last started a new paragraph at the top of page 5.
"I will not make excuses for what I have done, nor can I say that I did it while of unsound mind. I was furious and I made a mistake. It's that simple. Under other circumstances, those less terrible, I mean, I might say, it was a natural mistake. The two of them look almost enough alike to be twins. But these are not other circumstances. I have thought of atonement as I sat here, writing these pages and listening to his television and to the wind, not because I hope for forgiveness, but because it seems wrong to do wrong without at least trying to balance it out with something right." Here Tess thought of how the lottery winner and the man with the broken back evened out, but the concept would be difficult to express when she was so tired, and she wasn't sure it was germane anyway. "I thought of going to Africa and working with AIDS victims. I thought about going down to New Orleans and volunteering at a homeless shelter or a food bank. I thought about going to the Gulf to clean oil off birds. I thought of donating the $1 million or so I have put away for my retirement to some group that works to end violence against women. There must be such a society in Connecticut, perhaps even several of them. But then I thought of Doreen Marquis from the Knitting Society and what she says once in every book. What Doreen said at least once in every book was, 'Murderers always overlook the obvious. You may depend on it, dears.'" And even as Tess wrote about atonement, she realized it would be impossible, because Doreen was absolutely right. Tess had worn a cap so that she wouldn't leave hair that could be analyzed for DNA. She had worn gloves which she had never taken off, even while driving Alvin Strelke's pickup. It was not too late to burn this confession in Lester's kitchen wood stove, drive to Brother Alvin's considerably nicer house of bricks instead of house of sticks, get into her expedition, and head back to Connecticut. She could go home, where Fritzy was waiting. At first glance, she looked clear, and it might take the police a few days to get to her, but get to her they would. Because while she had been concentrating on the forensic molehills, she had overlooked the obvious mountain, exactly like the killers in the Knitting Society books. The obvious mountain had a name: Betsy Neal. A pretty woman with an oval face, mismatched Picasso eyes, and a cloud of dark hair. She had recognized Tess, had even gotten her autograph, but that wasn't the clincher. The clincher was going to be the bruises on her face. "I hope that didn't happen here," Neil had said. And the fact that Tess had asked about Alvin Strelke, describing his truck and recognizing the ring when Neil mentioned it.
Like a ruby,
Tess had agreed. Neil would see the story on TV or read it in the newspaper. With three dead from the same family, how could she avoid it? And she would go to the police. The police would come to Tess. They would check the Connecticut gun registration records, as a matter of course, and discover that Tess owned a .38 Smith & Wesson revolver known as a lemon squeezer. They would ask her to produce it so they could test fire it and do comparisons to the bullets found in the three victims. And what was she going to say? Was she going to look at them from her blackened eyes and say, in a voice still hoarse from the choking Lester Strelke had given her, that she lost it? Would she continue to stick to that story even after the dead women were found in the culvert pipe? Tess picked up her borrowed pen and began writing again.
What she says once in every book, murderers always overlook the obvious. Doreen also once took a leaf from Dorothy Sayre's book and left a murderer with a loaded gun, telling him to take the honorable way out. I have a gun. My brother Mike is my only surviving close relative. He lives in Taos, New Mexico. I suppose he may inherit my estate. It depends on the legal ramifications of my crimes. If he does, I hope the authorities who find this letter will show it to him and convey my wish that he donate the bulk to some charitable organization that works with women who have been sexually abused. I'm sorry about Big Driver, Alvin Strelke. He was not the man who raped me, and Doreen is sure he didn't rape and kill those other women either.
Doreen? No, her. Doreen wasn't real. But Tess was too tired to go back and change it. And what the hell? She was near the end anyway.
For Ramona and that piece of garbage in the other room, I make no apologies. They are better off dead. So, of course, am I.
She paused long enough to look back over the pages and see if there was anything she had forgotten. There didn't appear to be, so she signed her name, her final autograph. The pen ran dry in the last letter and she put it aside.
Got anything to say, Lester?
She asked. Only the wind replied, gusting hard enough to make the little house groan in its joints and puff drafts of cold air. She went back into the living room. She put the hat on his head and the ring on his finger. That was the way she wanted them to find him. There was a framed photograph on the TV. In it, Lester and his mother stood with their arms around each other. They were smiling. Just a boy and his mum. She looked at it for a while, then left. 42. She felt that she should go back to the deserted store where it had happened and finish her business there. She could sit for a while in the weedy lot, listen to the wind ticking the old sign, "You like it, it likes you," thinking about whatever people think about in the final moments of a life. In her case, that would probably be Fritzy. She guessed Patsy would take him, and that would be fine. Cats were survivors. They didn't much care who fed them, as long as the bowl was full. It wouldn't take long to get to the store at this hour, but it still seemed too far. She was very tired. She decided she would get into Al Strelke's old truck and do it there. But she didn't want to splatter her painfully written confession with her blood. That seemed very wrong, considering all the bloodshed detailed within it. And so, she took the pages from the Blue Horse tablet into the living room, where the TV played on. A young man who looked like a criminal was now selling a robot floor washer. And dropped them in Strelke's lap.
Hold that for me, Les, she said.
No problem, he replied.
She noted that a portion of his diseased brains was now drying on his bony, naked shoulder. That was all right. Tess went out into the windy dark and slowly climbed behind the wheel of the pickup truck. The scream of the hinge when the driver's door swung shut was oddly familiar.
But no, not so odd. Hadn't she heard it at the store? Yes, she had been trying to do him a favor because he was going to do her one. He was going to change her tire so she could go home and feed her cat.
I didn't want his battery to run down, she said, and laughed.
She put the short barrel of the .38 against her temple, then reconsidered. A shot like that wasn't always effective. She wanted her money to help women who had been hurt, not to pay for her care as she lay unconscious year after year in some home for human vegetables. The mouth. That was better. Sure. The barrel was oily against her tongue, and she could feel the small nub of the sight digging into the roof of her mouth.
I've had a good life, pretty good anyway, and although I made a terrible mistake at the end of it, maybe that won't be held against me if there's something after this.
But the night wind was very sweet. So were the fragile fragrances it carried through the half-open driver's side window. It was a shame to leave, but what choice? It was time to go. Tess closed her eyes, tightened her finger on the trigger, and that was when Tom spoke up. It was strange that he could do that, because Tom was in her expedition, and the expedition was at the other brother's house, almost a mile down the road from here. Also, the voice she heard was nothing like the one she usually manufactured for Tom, nor did it sound like her own. It was a cold voice, and she had a gun in her mouth. She couldn't talk at all. She was never a very good detective, was she? She took it out.
Who? Doreen?
In spite of everything, she was shocked. Who else, Tessa Jean? And why would she be a good one? She came from the old you, didn't she?
Tess supposed that was true.
Doreen believes Big Driver didn't rape and kill those other women. Isn't that what you wrote?
Me,
Tess said.
I'm sure. I was just tired, that's all. And shocked, I suppose.
Also guilty.
Yes, also guilty.
Do guilty people make good deductions, do you think? No, perhaps they didn't.
What are you trying to tell me?
That you only solved part of the mystery. Before you could solve all of it, you, not some cliché-ridden old lady detective, something admittedly unfortunate happened.
Unfortunate? Is that what you call it?
From a great distance, Tess heard herself laugh. Somewhere the wind was making a loose gutter click against an eave. It sounded like the 7-Up sign at the deserted store. Before you shoot yourself, the new strange Tom said.
He was sounding more female all the time.
Why don't you think for yourself? But not here.
Where then?
Tom didn't answer this question and didn't have to.
What he said was,
and take that fucking confession with you.
Tess got out of the truck and went back inside Lester Strelke's house. She stood in the dead man's kitchen thinking. She did it aloud in Tom's voice, which sounded more and more like her own all the time. Doreen seemed to have taken a hike. Al's house key will be on the ring with his ignition key, Tom said. But there's the dog. You don't want to forget the dog.
No, that would be bad.
Tess went to Lester's refrigerator. After a little rummaging, she found a package of hamburger at the back of the bottom shelf. She used an issue of Uncle Henry's to double wrap it, then went back into the living room. She plucked the confession from Strelke's lap, doing it gingerly, very aware that the part of him that had hurt her, the part that had gotten 3 people killed tonight, lay just beneath the pages.
I'm taking your ground, Chuck, but don't hold it against me. I'm doing you a favor. It smells spunky going on rotten.
A thief as well as a murderer, Little Driver said in his droning dead voice. Isn't that nice?
Shut up, Les, she said, and left.
43.
Before you shoot yourself, why don't you think for yourself?
As she drove the old pickup back down the windy road to Alvin Strelke's house, she tried to do that. She was starting to think Tom, even when he wasn't in the vehicle with her, was a better detective than Doreen Marquis on her best day.
I'll keep it short, Tom said. If you don't think Al Strelke was part of it, and I mean a big part, you're crazy.
Of course I'm crazy, she replied. Why else would I be trying to convince myself that I didn't shoot the wrong man when I know I did?
That's guilt talking, not logic, Tom replied. He sounded maddeningly smug,
He was no innocent little lamb, not even a half-black sheep. Wake up, Tessa Jean. They weren't just brothers. They were partners.
Business partners. Brothers are never just business partners. It's always more complicated than that, especially when you've got a woman like Ramona for a mother.
Tess turned up Al Strelke's smoothly paved driveway. She supposed Tom could be right about that. She knew one thing. Doreen and her knitting society friends had never met a woman like Ramona Norville. The pole light went on. The dog started up.
Yark, 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 yark.
Tess waited for the light to go out and the dog to quiet down.
There's no way I'll ever know for sure, Tom. You can't be certain of that unless you look. Even if he knew, he wasn't the one who raped me.
Tom was silent for a moment. She thought he'd given up. Then he said, when a person does a bad thing, and another person knows but doesn't stop it, they're equally guilty.
In the eyes of the law?
Also in the eyes of me. Say it was just Lester who did the hunting, the raping, and the killing. I don't think so, but say it was. If Big Brother knew and said nothing, that makes him worth killing. In fact, I'd say bullets were too good for him. Impaling on a hot poker would be closer to justice.
Tess shook her head wearily and touched the gun on the seat. One bullet left. If she had to use it on the dog, and really, what was one more killing among friends? She would have to hunt for another gun, unless she meant to try and hang herself or something. But guys like the Strelkies usually had firearms.
That was the beauty part, as Ramona would have said.
If he knew, yes. But an if that big didn't deserve a bullet in the head. The mother, yes, on that score. The earrings were all the proof I needed. But there's no proof here.
Really? Tom's voice was so low Tess could barely hear it.
Go see.
44. The dog didn't bark when she clumped up the steps, but she could picture it standing just inside the door with its head down and its teeth bared.
Goober?
What the hell? It was as good a name for a country dog as any.
My name's Tess. I have some hamburger for you. I also have a gun with one bullet in it. I'm gonna open the door now. If I were you, I'd choose the meat. Okay? Is it a deal?
Still no barking. Maybe it took the pole light to set him off. Or a juicy female burglar. Tess tried one key, then another. No good. Those two were probably for the trucking office. The third one turned in the lock, and she opened the door before she could lose her courage. She had been visualizing a bulldog or a Rottweiler or a pit bull with red eyes and slavering jaws. What she saw was a Jack Russell Terrier who was looking at her hopefully and thumping its tail. Tess put the gun in her jacket pocket and stroked the dog's head.
Good God,
she said.
To think I was terrified of you.
No need to be, Goober said. Say, where's Al?
Don't ask, she said. Want some hamburger?
I warn you, it may have gone off.
Give it to me, baby,
Goober said. Tess fed him a chunk of the hamburger, then came in, closed the door, and turned on the lights.
Why not? It was only her and Goober, after all.
Alvin Strelke had kept a neater house than his younger brother. The floors and walls were clean. There were no stacks of Uncle Henry's swap guide, and she actually saw a few books on the shelves. There were also several clusters of Hummel figures and a large framed photo of Momzilla on the wall. Tess found that a touch suggestive, but it was hardly proof positive of anything.
If there was a photo of Richard Widmark in his famous Tommy Udo role, that might be different.
What are you smiling about?
Goober asked.
Want to share?
Actually, no, Tess said. Where should we start?
I don't know,
Goober said.
I'm just the dog. How about some more of that tasty cow?
Tess fed him some more meat. Goober got up on his hind legs and turned around twice. Tess wondered if she were going insane.
Tom, anything to say?
You found your underpants at the other brother's house, right?
Yes, and I took them. They're torn, and I never want to wear them again, even if they weren't. But they're mine.
And what else did you find besides a bunch of undies?
What do you mean, what else?
But Tom didn't need to tell her that. It wasn't a question of what she had found. It was a question of what she hadn't. No purse and no keys. Lester Strelke had probably thrown the keys into the woods. It was what Tess herself would have done in his place. The bag was a different matter. It had been a Kate Spade, very pricey, and inside was a sewn-in strip of silk with her name on it. If the bag, and the stuff in the bag, wasn't at Lester's house, and if he didn't throw it into the woods with her keys, where is it?
I vote for here, Tom said. Let's look around.
Meat, Goober cried, and did another pirouette.
45. Where should she start?
Come on, Tom said. Men keep most of their secrets in one of two places, the study or the bedroom. Doreen might not have known that, but you do. And this house doesn't have a study. She went into Al Strelke's bedroom, trailed by Goober, where she found an extra-long double bed made up in no-nonsense military style. Tess looked under it. Nada. She started to turn toward the closet, paused, then pivoted back to the bed. She lifted the mattress, looked. After 5 seconds, maybe 10, she uttered a single word in a dry, flat voice.
Jackpot.
Lying on the box spring were three ladies' handbags. The one in the middle was a cream-colored clutch that Tess would have recognized anywhere. She flipped it open. There was nothing inside but some Kleenex and an eyebrow pencil with a cunning little lash comb hidden in the top half. She looked for the silk strip with her name on it, but it was gone. It had been removed carefully, but she saw one tiny cut in the fine Italian leather, where the stitches had been unpicked.
Yours? Tom asked.
You know it is.
What about the eyebrow pencil?
They sell those things by the thousands in drugstores all over America.
Is it yours?
Yes, it is.
Are you convinced yet?
Tess
swallowed.
She was feeling something, but she wasn't sure what it was. Relief? Horror? I guess I am. But why? Why both of them?
Tom didn't say. He didn't need to. Doreen might not know, or want to admit it if she did, because the old ladies who followed her adventures didn't like ookie stuff. But Tess supposed she did. Because Mommy fucked both of them up. That's what a psychiatrist would say. Lester was the rapist. Al was the fetishist who participated vicariously. Maybe he even helped with one or both of the women in the pipe. She'd never know for sure.
It would probably take until dawn to search the whole house, Tom said. But you can search the rest of this room, Tessa Jean. He probably destroyed everything from the purse, cut up the credit cards and tossed them in the College River, would be my guess. But you have to make sure, because anything with your name on it would lead the police right to your door. Start with the closet.
Tess didn't find her credit cards or anything else belonging to her in the closet, but she did find something. It was on the top shelf. She got off the chair she'd been standing on and studied it with growing dismay. A stuffed duck that might have been some child's favorite toy. One of its eyes was missing, and its synthetic fur was matted. That fur was actually gone in places, as if the duck had been petted half to death. On the faded yellow beak was a dark maroon splash.
Is that what I think it is? Tom asked.
Oh, Tom, I think so.
The bodies you saw in the culvert, could one of them have been a child's body?
No, neither of them had been that small. But maybe the culvert running beneath Stag Road hadn't been the Strelke brothers' only body dump.
Put it back on the shelf. Leave it for the police to find. You need to make sure he doesn't have a computer with stuff on it about you. Then you need to get the hell out of here.
Something cold and wet nuzzled Tess's hand. She almost screamed. It was Goober, looking up at her with bright eyes.
More meat,
Goober said, and Tess gave him some. If Al Strelke has a computer, Tess said, you can be sure it's password protected, and his probably won't be open for me to poke around in.
Then take it and throw it in the goddamn river when you go home. Let it sleep with the fishes.
But there was no computer. At the door, Tess fed Goober the rest of the hamburger. He would probably puke it all up on the rug, but that wasn't going to bother Big Driver. Tom said,
Are you satisfied, Tessa Jean? Are you satisfied you didn't kill an innocent man?
She supposed she must be, because suicide no longer seemed like an option.
What about Betsy Neal, Tom? What about her?
Tom didn't answer, and once again didn't need to. Because after all, he was she, wasn't she? Tess wasn't entirely sure about that. And did it matter, as long as she knew what to do next? As for tomorrow, it was another day. Scarlett O'Hara had been right about that much. What mattered most was that the police had to know about the bodies in the culvert, if only because somewhere there were friends and relatives who were still wondering. Also because the stuffed duck says there might be more.
That was her own voice, and that was all right.
46. At 7:30 the next morning, after less than 3 hours of broken, nightmare-haunted sleep, Tess booted up her office computer. But not to write. Writing was the farthest thing from her mind.
Was Betsy Neal single?
Tess thought so. She had seen no wedding ring that day in Neal's office, and while she might have missed that, there had been no family pictures either. The only picture she could remember seeing was a framed photo of Barack Obama, and he was already married. So yes, Betsy Neal was probably divorced or single, and probably unlisted, in which case a computer search would do her no good at all. Tess supposed she could go to the Stagger Inn and find her there, but she didn't want to go back to the Stagger. Ever again.
Why are you buying trouble? Fritzy said from the windowsill. At least check the telephone listings for college. And what's that I smell on you? Is that dog?
Yes, that's Goober.
Traitor,
Fritzy said contemptuously. Her search turned up an even dozen Neals. One was an E Neal.
E for Elizabeth?
There was only one way to find out. With no hesitation, that would have almost certainly caused her to lose her courage. Tess punched in the number. She was sweating and her heart was beating rapidly. The phone rang once, twice.
It's probably not her. It could be an Edith Neal,
an Edwina Neal,
even an Elvira Neal.
Three times. If it is Betsy Neal's phone, she's probably not even there. She's probably on vacation in the Catskills. Four times. Or shacked up with one of the zombie bakers. How about that? The lead guitarist. They probably sing Can Your Pussy Do the Dog together in the shower after they... The phone was picked up, and Tess recognized the voice in her ear at once. Hello, you've reached Betsy, but I can't come to the phone right now. There's a beep coming, and you know what to do when you hear it. Have a nice day. I had a bad day, thanks. And last night was ever so much work. The beep came, and Tess heard herself talking before she was even aware she meant to. Hello, Ms. Neal, this is Tessa Jean calling, the Willow Grove lady. We met at the Stagger Inn. You gave me back my tom-tom and I signed an autograph for your gran. You saw how marked up I was and I told you some lies. It wasn't a boyfriend, Miss Neal. Tess began to speak faster, afraid that the message tape would run out before she finished, and she discovered she badly wanted to finish. I was raped, and that was bad. But then I tried to make it right, and I have to talk to you about it because... There was a click on the line, and then Betsy Neal herself was in Tess's ear. Start again, she said, but just go slow.
I just woke up and I'm still half asleep.
47. They met for lunch on the college town common. They sat on a bench near the bandstand. Tess didn't think she was hungry, but Betsy Neal forced a sandwich on her, and Tess found herself eating it in large bites that made her think of Goober snarfing up Lester Strelke's hamburger.
"Start at the beginning," Betsy said. She was calm, Tess thought, almost preternaturally so. "Start from the beginning and tell me everything."
Tess began with the invitation from Books and Brown Baggers. Betsy Neal said little, only occasionally adding an "uh-huh," or "okay," to let Tess know she was still following the story. Telling it was thirsty work. Luckily, Betsy had also brought 2 cans of Dr. Brown's cream soda. Tess took one and drank it greedily. When she finished, it was past 1 in the afternoon. The few people who had come to the common to eat their lunches were gone. There were 2 women walking babies in strollers, but they were a good distance away.
"Let me get this straight," Betsy Neal said. "You were going to kill yourself, and then some phantom voice told you to go back to Alvin Strelke's house instead."
"Yes," Tess replied, "where I found my purse and the duck with the blood on it."
"Your panties you found in the younger brother's house?"
"Little drivers, yes. They're in my expedition. And the purse. Do you want to see them?"
"No. What about the gun?"
"That's in the car, too, with 1 bullet left in it."
She looked at Neil curiously, thinking,
"The girl with the Picasso eyes. Aren't you afraid of me? You're the one loose end. The only one I can think of, anyway."
"We're in a public park, Tess. Also, I've got quite the confession on my answering machine at home."
Tess blinked. Something else she hadn't thought of.
"Even if you somehow managed to kill me without those 2 young mothers over there noticing."
"I'm not up for killing anyone else, here or anywhere."
"Good to know. Because even if you took care of me and my answering machine tape, sooner or later someone would find the cab driver who brought you out to the Stagger on Saturday morning. And when the police got to you, they'd find you wearing a load of incriminating bruises."
"Yes,"
Tess said, touching the worst of them.
"That's true. So what now?"
"For one thing, I think you'd be wise to stay out of sight as much as you can until your pretty face looks pretty again."
"I think I'm covered there," Tess said, and told Betsy the tale she had confabulated for Patsy McLean's benefit.
"That's pretty good."
"Miss Neal?"
"Betsy.
Do you believe me?"
"Oh, yes," she said, almost absently. "Now listen. Are you listening?"
Tess nodded. "We're a couple of women having a little picnic in the park, and that's fine. But after today, we're not going to see each other again, right?"
"If you say so,"
Tess said. Her brain felt the way her jaw did after the dentist gave her a healthy shot of Novocaine.
"I do. And you need to have another story made up and ready, just in case the cops talk to either the limo driver who took you home."
"Manuel. His name was Manuel."
"Or the driver who took you out to the Stagger on Saturday morning. I don't think anybody will make the connection between you and the Strelkes as long as none of your ID shows up. But when the story breaks, this is going to be big news, and we can't assume the investigation won't touch you."
She leaned forward and tapped Tess once above the left breast.
"I'm counting on you to make sure that it never touches me, because I don't deserve that."
"No, she absolutely didn't."
"What story could you tell the cops, hon? Something good without me in it. Come on, you're the writer."
Tess thought for a full minute. "Betsy Letter. I'd say Ramona Norval told me about the Stag Road shortcut after my appearance, which is true, and that I saw the Stagger Inn when I drove by. I'd say I stopped for dinner a few miles down the road, then decided to go back and have a few drinks, listen to the band."
"That's good. They're called..."
"I know what they're called," Tess said. Maybe the Novocaine was wearing off. "I'd say I met some guys, drank a bunch, and decided I was too blitzed to drive. You're not in this story because you don't work nights. I could also say..."
"Never mind. That's enough. You're pretty good at this stuff once you get cooking.
Just don't embellish too much.
I won't, Tess said. And this is one story I might not ever have to tell. Once they have the Strelkies and the Strelkies' victims, they'll be looking for a killer a lot different than a little book-writing lady like me.
Betsy Neal smiled. Little book-writing lady my ass. You're one bad bitch.
Then she saw the look of startled alarm on Tess's face.
What? What now?
They will be able to tie the women in the pipe to the Strelkies, won't they? At least to Lester?
Did he put on a rubber before he raped you?
No, God no. His stuff was still on my thighs when I got home. And inside me.
She shuddered. Then he'll have gone in bareback with the others. Plenty of evidence. They'll put it together. As long as those bad boys really got rid of your ID, you should be home and dry. And there's no sense worrying about what you can't control, is there?
No.
As for you, not planning on going home and cutting your wrists in the bathtub, are you? Or are you using that last bullet?
No.
Tess thought of how sweet the night air had smelled as she sat in the truck with the short barrel of the lemon squeezer in her mouth.
No, I'm good.
Then it's time for you to leave. I'll sit here a little longer.
Tess started to get off the bench, then sat down again. There's something I need to know. You're making yourself an accessory after the fact. Why would you do that for a woman you don't even know? A woman you've only met once.
Would you believe because my gran loves your books and would be very disappointed if you went to jail for a triple murder?
Not a bit,
Tess said. Betsy said nothing for a moment. She picked up her can of Dr. Brown's, then put it back down again. Lots of women get raped, wouldn't you say? I mean, you're not unique in that respect, are you?
No,
Tess knew she was not unique in that respect. But knowing it did not make the pain and shame any less. Nor would it help with her nerves while she waited for the results of the AIDS test she'd soon be taking.
Betsy smiled. There was nothing pleasant about it, or pretty.
Women all over the world are being raped as we speak. Girls, too. Some who undoubtedly have favorite stuffed toys. Some are killed and some survive. Of the survivors, how many do you think report what happened to them?
Tess shook her head.
I don't know either, Betsy said. But I know what the National Crime Victimization Survey says, because I Googled it. 60% of rapes go unreported, according to them. 3 in every 5. I think that might be low, but who can say for sure? Outside of math classes, it's hard to prove a negative. Impossible, really.
Who raped you? Tess asked.
My stepfather. I was 12. He held a butter knife to my face while he did it. I kept still. I was scared. But the knife slipped when he came. Probably not on purpose, but who can say?
Betsy pulled down the lower lid of her left eye with her left hand. The right she cupped beneath it, and the glass eye rolled neatly into that palm. The empty socket was mildly red and up-tilted, seeming to stare out at the world with surprise.
The pain was, well, there's no way to describe pain like that. Not really. It seemed like the end of the world to me. There was blood, too. Lots. My mother took me to the doctor. She said I was to tell them I was running in my stocking feet and slipped on the kitchen linoleum because she just waxed it. That I pitched forward and put out my eye on the corner of the kitchen counter. She said the doctor would want to speak to me alone and she was depending on me. I know he did a terrible thing to you, she said. But if people find out, they'll blame me. Please, baby, do this one thing for me and I'll make sure nothing bad ever happens to you again. So that's what I did.
And did it happen again?
3 or 4 more times. And I always kept still because I had only one eye left to donate to the cause. Listen, are we done here or not?
Tess moved to embrace her, but Betsy cringed back. Like a vampire who sees a crucifix, Tess thought.
Don't do that, Betsy said.
But...
I know, mucho thanks. Solidarity, sisterhood forever, blah, blah, blah. I don't like to be hugged, that's all. Are we done here or not?
We're done.
Then go. And I throw out that gun of yours in the river on your way back home. Did you burn the confession?
Yes, you bet.
Betsy nodded. And I'll erase the message you left on my answering machine.
Tess walked away. She looked back once. Betsy Neal was still sitting on the bench. She had put her eye back in. 48. In her expedition, Tess realized it might be an extremely good idea to delete her last few journeys from her GPS. She pushed the power button, and the screen brightened. Tom said,
"Hello, Tess. I see we're taking a trip."
Tess finished making her deletions, then turned the GPS unit off again. No trip. Not really. She was only going home. And she thought she could find the way by herself.
8.